Welcome to the LSE for this evening's event on aging and sexualities. Not a topic that we talk about a lot at the LSE, but something that obviously all of us at the table are incredibly interested in, and I trust you all are interested in as well, which is why you're here. My name is Dr. Tim Hildebrandt. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Social Policy, where I do, among other things, research on issues related to sexualities and social policy, which is why I'm here. And on behalf of the Hellenic Observatory and the Department of Social Policy, the co-sponsors of the event today, I want to welcome you. I'm incredibly excited for this event, as I have been for the last, I think, 6 months since it's been in plan. We're here very pleased to welcome Debbie Laycock and Konstantinos Fellas to the event. Debbie Laycock is head of policy and parliamentary affairs at the Terence Higgins Trust. She's been head of policy at THT for the past 2 years and has been working in the public health sector for the last 10. Prior to that, she did graduate work at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is just down the road. Konstantinos Fellas is a medical sociologist and vice rector for faculty and research at the University of Nicosia in Cyprus. We've also been incredibly lucky to have him here at the LSE for the last year as a visiting professor affiliated with the Hellenic Observatory. But Konstantinos also gave an incredibly well-received popular lecture in my sexuality class on aging. So I was thrilled to be able to welcome him once again and have him sort of share all of his great insights today as well. For those of you in the audience who use Twitter, which I am not one, but if you use Twitter, there is a hashtag for the event, which would be hashtag LSE Cyprus. But we do ask that you have your phones on silent so that you don't disrupt others. After the presentations, we will have a Q&A session, which, again, I trust will be very lively and interesting for everyone. So just a little bit about the plan here. Konstantinos will speak for about 10 minutes, sort of laying the framework for the research. Then Debbie will present the UK research findings for about 15 minutes. And then Konstantinos will come back again and present the Cyprus findings for 15 minutes. And then we have 40 minutes or more or less to do some Q&A. Are we ready? Excited?
Yes.
Yes. Go for it.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much, Tim, for your warm welcome and warm introduction. A big thank you to the Hellenic Observatory for the excellent organization, especially to Polly, who sits over there. And I'm very pleased to be here with Debbie as well. I'm going to give you a short introduction about the background of this research, this comparative piece of research. And so over the next 10 minutes, please, Debbie, stop me. Polly, stop me. I'm going to give you a small introduction about aging and sexualities, aging, HIV and AIDS, elderly LGBT and HIV and AIDS, some social factors, and the conclusions. So, HIV rates are climbing in the over 50s in the UK and across Europe, while the rate of new infections among younger people is dropping. This study, which was published in September 2017, in Sweden, says that older people are most likely to be infected through heterosexual sex. Their doctors also tend to assume that older people are not running risks through unsafe sex. They make the presumption that all people, if you are over 50, you do not have sex, which is a myth. The study's authors also suggest that the over 50s may be either complacent or ignorant of the risk of HIV, which has dropped out of the headlines since it became a treatable disease. The study was published in the Lancet HIV Journal in September 2017 has found that 1 in 6 new cases of HIV are in people over the age of 50. And between 2004 and 2015, the rate of diagnosis in older people increased in 16 countries. That included the UK, where the rate of new diagnoses went up from 3.1 per 100,000 to 4.32. Belgium, Germany, and Ireland also saw rises in the rate of infection among older people. By 2015, the rate in over 50s was highest in Estonia, Latvia, Malta, and Portugal. And infection through sex between men increased in both age groups between 2004 and 2005. Also, in the UK, I'm sure Debbie will tell us more, in the recent years, there has been a steady increase in HIV, the diagnosis amongst people of the age of 50, accounting for 9% of new cases in 2006 and 17% in 2015, which is a dramatic increase. A couple of words, what is happening in the United States? As of 2017, 50% of people with HIV in the United States will be age 50 and older. By 2020, dear friends, more than 70% of Americans with HIV are expected to be 50 and older. This epidemic has disproportionately impacted LGBT people and people of color since its inception. New HIV infections are also on the rise amongst older people, many of whom are likely to be duly diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. And yet, research experience shows that few aging and health professionals are equipped to address the unique needs of older adults with HIV and AIDS. Furthermore, public policies rarely consider older people with HIV or provide sufficient funding for programs, research, and other interventions that could improve the quality of life for older adults with HIV. And therefore, if you look around you, there is very limited public conversation on both aging and HIV and AIDS. On one hand, you have aging, you have sexualities, and you have HIV and AIDS. I call it the triple jeopardy, if that's the right word in English. So it's a lethal combination of three factors. Older adults are often not tested for HIV because of providers' misconceptions that they are no longer sexually active. Furthermore, many LGBT older people often delay medical care for fear of discrimination, and we'll come back to that when I present you the Cyprus findings. Now, a few words about elderly people and elderly LGBT and HIV and AIDS. As I said, research shows that both heterosexual and LGBT older adults are sexually active into their mid-80s. And a recent national study showing 53% of adults aged between 64 and 74 are being active with one or more partners. HIV and AIDS, as I said to you, it disproportionately also affects LGBT people and people of color. If you are coming from an ethnic minority community where there is limited funding there in order to explore HIV and AIDS there, we have more complicated cases. In the United States, the African Americans, if I go back, there African Americans and Latinos are 12 and 5 times more likely to be HIV positive than their peers. Also, transgender people are at high risk for HIV. HIV, my dear friends, is also a concern for lesbian and bisexual older women, which is often neglected from the literature. In addition, some lesbians, bisexual women, and female sex workers have sexual histories with HIV-positive men or intravenous drug users and have self-reported participating in sex work for money or drugs behaviors and experiences that pose great risk for HIV and AIDS infection. Women who no longer worry about becoming pregnant may be less likely to use a condom and to practice safer sex. Older people are less likely than younger people to discuss their sexual habits or drug use with their doctors. Doctors are less likely to ask their older patients about these issues. So you are getting the picture. So what is, now let's talk a couple of minutes on LGBT. What's happening with LGBT elderly people? Now, why, what is causing this? That people over 50, the rate of infection is rapidly increasing. Sexual health campaigners have identified what is called prevention fatigue as a factor. This is when gay men who have been listening to safe sex messages for decades begin to stop listening. Years of remaining also HIV negative can sometimes lead people to think they can allow themselves to indulge in risk-taking behaviors. Lots of gay men who grew up in the 80s and 90s who managed not to contact the virus have grown tired of constantly having sexual health messages thrown at them. It creates a barrier where these men tend to ignore new prevention methods such as PrEP. Now, other factors beside prevention fatigue, well, we have loneliness and isolation. We have the breakdown of a long-term relationship. Lots of gay and bisexual men don't use condoms while being in a long-term relationship. Also, it can be difficult to go back to use condoms after a long time. Also, concerns about aging, the public image. How do gay men over 50 appear in the public? The body image is very important. Relationships with younger men, desirability factor, a generation marked by AIDS, search for intimacy and satisfaction of aging, all these play an important role in discussing aging. A few more minutes and I'm done. Also, we need to examine the risk discourses, the accounting for unsafe sex, trading off safe sex, condoms versus erections, all this mortality and self-preservation, all these, they come under the umbrella of risk discourses. And social factors, social stigma is a particular concern among older people because they may already face isolation due to illness or loss of family and friends. And also, stigma negatively affects people's quality of life, self-image, and behavior. Also, as I said, older people may find themselves newly single following a divorce, a breakup, or bereavement in later life, and they have not thought about HIV prevention for a long time. Also, being in a relationship can also lead people into thinking there is no need to have a regular sexual transmitted disease checkup. So, HIV is a major issue for all ages. Prevention messages must reach all those who need it. The role of social media and online advertising outweighs traditional methods. Also, people over 50, and we have Adrian here who used to work for the Tennessee Club, and he can. Then these people over 50 who are not on Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, probably, and they are not looking at cat videos on YouTube, there is no way to access them via the social media. So, and I will talk about it when I present the Cyprus findings. It's a problematic group of people from the methodological perspective. How do you access these people? Therefore, there is a need for creative and innovative ways to reach older gay and bisexual men with information about testing, PrEP, along with condom use, information that works for them. And the conclusions? Old age, if you read about it, is characterized as asexual. I mean, if you think about your father and mother, you know, you don't really think about of them having sex. So really, old age is closely interconnected with being asexual. And there is this ingrained age within society. Only young people have sex. Only young people enjoy sex. Ultimately, old age is characterized as asexual because of this perception that sexuality represents all those lovely things that we want to be associated with. We are feeling good. It's about power. It's about wealth. It's about beauty. It's about intuitionally being young. Therefore, how can one talk about old age and sexuality at the same time? And old age, by contrast, represents all that is feared about being human. In other words, you depend on people. You become on others. There is economic dependency. There is ugliness. There is sickness and death. So really, sexuality doesn't fit into that. Also, you pick up any magazine, you watch any TV, we are obsessed nowadays with successful aging, and we are trying so hard to stay young. We are buying clothes, we are buying expensive face creams and body lotions, and suddenly, anyone who fails to succeed, then, because of age-related illness, and you cannot keep forever a young body, there is a failure with that. So, also, there are societal norms which define what sexual is. And this incompatibility between old age and sexuality becomes highly evident. So, sexuality is all that old age is not. Healthy, as I said, and adults of all ages are left with little choice but to be sexual in order to remain socially engaged. So, and sexual intercourse, which is the sexual expression of being young, comes into play as well. Of people over 50 and 60 and 70, maybe they do not engage into sexual intercourse, and yet they remain sexually active. So again, something we need to think about it. So, we need, and I'm closing, we have to make both healthcare workers and the general population aware of this issue in order to reduce stigma. We need to come up with innovative HIV test approaches and need to provide comprehensive HIV prevention programs in order to tackle all these issues. And thank you for your attention. So that was the background why both the Tennessee Peace Trust and the University of Cyprus came together in order to explore all these issues.
Excellent. Perfect overview. Thank you so much for inviting me. So in case you don't know who Terence Higgins Trust is or what we do, so we're an HIV and sexual health organisation. We work across the UK, mostly frontline services, but obviously policy and campaigns work as well, which is where I come in. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the piece of research we did over the past year, the report of which was launched in January. And I'll give a bit of a background first. I think most of these have been covered, but basically we are seeing that there are both new HIV diagnoses in the over 50s population in the UK, but also we are in such a good position in the UK in that we have highly effective HIV medication now, ART, so we're thankfully seeing people living with HIV age, live into older life. So the total number of people in the UK age 50 plus living with HIV is rising. A little bit here, let's see if it's, oh yeah. So late diagnosis in individuals living with HIV has a direct impact on that individual's health and well-being, but can also impact others where an individual unwittingly pass HIV on. And what we're seeing in the UK is that people living with older people 50 plus living who are diagnosed with HIV even tend to be diagnosed late. So as you mentioned, there is something about awareness of HIV within that population. Over 50, so about a quarter in women, three quarters men. And to put it into context as well, so it's not just HIV that's increasing in this age group as well, so other STIs are as well. So, just an overview. So one in three people, as you mentioned, are living with HIV in the UK, 50 plus. So our study, In 2010, Terence Higgins Trust, along with Age UK and Joseph Rowntree Foundation, did a piece of work looking at HIV and ageing, and it was one of the first of its kind. So it was one of the first pieces of research that really looked at the changing dynamics in HIV. When I came into THT 2 years ago, it was an absolutely fantastic piece of work, but so much has changed in that time. So I really wanted to see how we could update that and make sure that all of our work was really evidence-based. So the purpose of the research we did was to really update the evidence-based thinking from a policy perspective, but also colleagues in the room, ex-colleagues in the room, to think about how Terence Higgins Trust can better provide services for people living with HIV or at risk of HIV who are 50 plus. So the methodology we used peer-led research design methodology. So we trained up 12 peer researchers who were people aged 50 and over living with HIV to co-produce the research with us. It was a first for us to work in this way, and I'm never going back. It was fantastic. So the peer researchers all had some kind of transferable skills, but we provided them with updated training, especially around facilitation and data collection. And they were involved in all stages of the research. So when we came to data analysis, they helped to interpret our research with us. They helped in dissemination, in thinking about workshop methodology, etc. Absolutely crucial to this piece of research. Our research had three prongs. So we did a survey, one-to-one interviews, and participatory workshops. We had 246 surveys completed, 30 one-to-one interviews, and 6 workshops, which I think had about 10 people, up to 10 people each. So in total, 307 people living with HIV age 50 plus participated. I'm doing a piece of work around HIV and women at the moment, so I was really pleased to see that it was kind of representative. So about a quarter of respondents were women. And a huge variety of responses, so from people who were diagnosed in 1982 to 2016, the year that we carried out the research, and the respondents' age at diagnosis again varied, so people who were diagnosed age 18 or a lot later in life at 74. In 1996 in the UK, effective HIV treatment was available, so I'll talk a bit later, but we also looked at analyses by people who were diagnosed pre-1996 and after, and there is a variation, and just to say that one third of people who participated in the research were diagnosed before 1996. So our findings. The first thing I want to say, because we're asked quite a lot, is we are not assuming that everyone 50 plus living with HIV is the same, has the same experiences. It's a hugely diverse group, and there are some themes that seem to be coming out from certain people or based on certain demographics, but I always just want to say, first of all, that we're looking at a diverse group. Mm-hmm. And you know, the demographics, a 32-year age group between the participants who responded from 50 upwards. Of course, what unites these individuals is their HIV status and the very physical impact of HIV on the ageing process. But everything else differs, from their occupation to their gender to their sexuality to their ethnicity. So this all has an impact on experience of living with HIV. So the first finding was around availability of treatment, so that 1996 year I mentioned. And there seemed to be two different experiences depending on whether you were diagnosed before 1996 or afterwards. So individuals who responded who were pre-1996 were more likely to rely on benefits as their sole income. They were more likely to be unemployed, and their health and well-being was a lot lower, so they were more likely to have three or more additional health conditions. On the other side, so individuals who were diagnosed since 1996, they seem to have, in general, of course this is generalising, a very different experience of being diagnosed. So this quote here, it's controllable infection, pop a pill a day and you'll be fine. So this cohort of individuals, they were twice as likely to rate their well-being as good or very good, and they were more likely to have 0 to 2 additional health conditions, so a lot less. The second finding that I wanted to mention was, and I know this is kind of common sense, but I like to bring it out, that 50 plus is not a single category. Mm. We have a programme at Terence Higgins Trust which is for the 50 plus population, but we of course look at specific needs and experiences within those groups. So we found there was specific experiences if between the 50 to 60-year-olds, 65 plus, and then the sort of 61 to 64 seemed to be a bit of a transition period. So we'd all agree, I think, that 50 is definitely not old, as we all get towards 50. So society deems that people 50 to 60 are of working age, you should be in employment. So we found that this age group had a lot more concerns around welfare and employment. They were more likely, interestingly, to demonstrate self-stigma, so especially HIV self-stigma, and they were very future-focused, so thinking about what will happen in age, when I'm older, how will I manage my health conditions, what will the long-term impact of HIV be, lots around mental health, lots around loneliness, so very much thinking about the future. On the flip side, it seemed to be people who were 65 plus were kind of okay in their own skin. So they were so more likely to rate their well-being as good or very good. So really high, 77%. They seemed to have a better relationship with GPs. So felt that their GPs had a lot more knowledge around HIV. They were either better off financially or felt that they were better off financially. So only 9% never or rarely had enough money to meet their basic needs. And then 45% felt that they always had enough money. And I love this quote. So it's, I think I've just reached a point in my life now where I'm settled in myself. What will be, will be. You expect to get ill when you get old. So that doesn't really bother me. And that came out quite a lot, in especially the sort of 70-plus age group. So the third thing is around poverty, which came up a lot during the research. So we found that 58% of respondents age 50 plus were defined as living on or below the poverty line, and that's actually double that of the general population. And a lot has changed, unfortunately, since the 2010 research we did, and this is one of those factors that's gone up. So in 2010, 48% of the respondents were on or below the poverty line, and that's gone up to 58%. In the 50 to 64 age group, only 45% of individuals are economically active, and that's compared to 72% in the general population. So it identified a lot of needs around finances that weren't necessarily being met. Yeah, this quote, so the money is gone, that's all gone, but I mean, we'd spend our holidays having fun, thinking we're going to just spend up until we died. I didn't bother with pensions or savings, what was the point? But now my partner died, but I lived, so I'm lucky, but I struggle with money, we spent it all. And that was something that came out quite a lot in individuals who were diagnosed really early on in the HIV and AIDS epidemic. So linked to that, so around welfare, we found that just over a third of respondents were solely reliant on benefits, and a further 5% relied on benefits as a major part of their income. There was a definite link between benefits, welfare, and individual health and well-being. So individuals who were receiving benefits had a lot lower levels of well-being and the highest levels of HIV self-stigma. And there, this is a quote, again, things that came up quite often, which was around the perception of people who are reliant on benefits. So there's a definite attitude that if your life is dependent on government money, then your life is less valued than those people who are working. And I get very resentful about that. That came out a lot. Thinking about the future, planning for the future. So we asked specific questions around what concerns you most about the future living with HIV. There was a lot around poor health and the link between health, employability, how you're going to support yourself, and the link between finances and quality of life. So 84% were concerned about future financial difficulties, and 56% were concerned about their ability to find or sustain employment in the future, and that was particularly in the people 65 or under. I put this really horrible diagram just because it was actually from the 2010 research, but it still stands. So it's just the interplay between HIV, ageing, as you mentioned, HIV, ageing, comorbidities, employment. It just all wraps up together. Social care, something that came out throughout the research. So every week at the moment in the UK, a new story comes out around the degree to which social care can provide for the whole population in the future. So it's not just about people living with HIV. The social care system in this country is on its knees in many ways. But in our research, we found that people living with HIV over 50 were really concerned around social care. So 82% were concerned around how they would access adequate social care in the future. And a lot of people, 88%, had not made any financial plans to find future social future social care. So if it wasn't provided on the state, they really didn't know where they would get the funds to access it. We had lots of cases where, and I'll come on to this in a minute, a lack of up-to-date information on HIV within the social care sector. So there was one case, this participant, who his family had tried to get him into residential social care. He was living with HIV. HIV was fine, totally under control, yet the residential provider was trying to double his fees to compensate for the extra burden of HIV, when there was absolutely no burden at all. And this links to... Oh, I'll do this quickly. So the big worry for the future is this social care thing. I think that is the big issue, which we need to start exploring. What is needed? And do I, as a gay man, need something different? Do I, as someone with HIV, need something different? I don't have any kids of my own. I don't have that safety net. And as I was just mentioning, discrimination came out a lot. So it was evident that... the social care sector in the UK is not yet HIV ready. So they have not seen that many people living with HIV. They don't understand HIV. I like to think it's based on misinformation rather than malice. But we don't in the UK have a social care sector which understands the needs of people living with HIV. And this came through a lot. This resident, it makes me angry every time I think about it. So it was like being in the 1980s. So this older gentleman was only allowed one seat, was only allowed his own cutlery. Every time he changed the TV, it was wiped down afterwards, which, of course, as you all know, you cannot pass HIV on through that at all. And he actually was on really good HIV treatment, which meant that his viral load was undetectable, so he couldn't pass HIV on. And this is happening more and more. Another thing that came out of the research was around long-term condition management. So we found that people living with HIV age 50 plus had three times as many long-term conditions as the general population. The vast majority of people were concerned how they manage multiple health conditions. So we heard a lot about how people were going, you know, six health conditions, each had to go to a different healthcare setting. Their doctors often didn't talk to each other. And they really weren't sure how they were going to manage all of these different burdens of infection, of health conditions. This is the first generation of people living with HIV to be on ART, so antiretroviral therapy, for a long period of time. So a lot of people were worried about the kind of the unknown. So what does it actually mean to be on HIV treatment for a long period of time? Most people had at least one long-term condition in addition to HIV. A lot came out around mental health, depression, anxiety, and there's lots of studies out there, like the Stigma Index, which reinforces this. So much came out about health issues. Social isolation and loneliness has been mentioned before. We found that 82% of people living with HIV age 50 plus had experienced moderate to high levels of loneliness, and this is actually three times higher than those people in the general population. And when we were talking to people in the one-to-one interviews and the workshops, people didn't want that much. They just wanted opportunities for social engagement, a desire for sort of local HIV prevention, social care services, so being able to interact with people who have gone through the same experiences. And I just wanted to end on this, as I mentioned, because I'm doing a project on HIV and women as well, and it's they're really a kind of invisible face of HIV in the UK. So we know that a quarter of people living with HIV 50 plus are women. In all age groups, a third of people are women. So this 50 plus age group is going to increase. We found in our research that women were more concerned about every aspect of growing older with HIV than men, and lots of things around dependence, children, family. They reported lower levels of well-being, and on lower incomes than men as well. So there's lots of issues around financial concerns in the future. There was a bit of a whistle-stop tour, but thank you very much for. I'm very happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie, so much. I think Debbie has presented a brilliant. Yes. Okay. Should work. Yeah. Security alert.
Should be okay.
If I go back.
Excellent. Great.
Okay. Thank you so much. The methodology is exactly the same. We have used the same questionnaire, which was designed and constructed by the Tennessee Kids Trust. It was translated into Greek, of course, in order to make it more easily accessible to the people there. I give you a brief introduction. The same objectives, like the Tennessee Kids Trust survey. It's very interesting to say, if you remember one thing, that most of the issues you have touched upon, social care system, social stigma, loneliness, isolation, they are exactly, we have found the same findings in Cyprus as well. There, the only difference is that people are not reluctant to talk about their status. Therefore, how do we expect the professionals there and the doctors and the people working under the social care system to be aware of their needs if those people living with HIV and AIDS do not come forward and talk about it? Now, Cyprus. Between 1986 and 2015, Cyprus recorded 983 cases, with the majority being civilians. The manner of infection was mainly sexual contact. And if you break it down into 51% heterosexual and 41% homosexual behavior. Women contacted the virus mostly through heterosexual intercourse, and of those 514 civilians carriers, 482 were men. And 31% of the cases were among the ages of 40 and 60 plus. And that's the group we are interested in. A 2014 report by the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control identified that in Cyprus there were no sexual health information activities, and the public sector was itself a barrier to HIV testing, primarily due to lack of anonymity and confidentiality. So this preamble is very important in order for you to start getting the picture and to examine the findings I'm going to present you against the backdrop of this. People living with HIV in Cyprus, they fear facing rejection if their HIV status was to be discovered by other people on a small island like Cyprus, where everybody knows everything about everybody. And visibly, not being able to speak openly about one's HIV status is a very tough burden for people living with HIV. NGOs that work on HIV in Cyprus all report various prevention support services, but they have a very tough job due to lack of funding. Also, it appears that the general prevention campaigns, they target mainly young people instead of focusing on elderly people as well. Now, the funding was provided by the University of Nicosia. The data collection was between April 2017 and September 2017. I was principal investigator. And now let's move. And 27 people living over 50, living with HIV and AIDS, were recruited in order to take part in a self-completed questionnaire, which was designed by the Tennessee Trust. We also carried out five semi-structured face-to-face interviews. Now, findings. Very, very, very quickly. I'm going to present you. My findings are not as glamorous and as like Debbie's, but I've, I've, I decided to present you the raw data rather than summarize. And then we can talk about it during the question and answer session. Most of the people who took part, there were 64, they were male, and 32 were females. How do you define their sexual orientation? 55%, they reported as heterosexual, and only 20% really of the people who took part, they reported as gay, and the other ones are pansexual. Yeah. Interesting, Debbie, 50% of the population, they consider themselves as having a disability. I'm giving you a summary. I'm more than happy to, maybe if I send you to the whole lot, we can circulate it to the people who are here. How would you rate your current well-being? We see that if you 30%, they reported their current well-being as bad or as very bad. So 30% of the participants, they had health problems and they expressed their quality of lives as bad or very bad. Are you currently affected by any of the following? You can see here that diabetes, high blood pressure and high cholesterol, arthritis, heart diseases, if you, those five diseases are over and above their HIV status. Mm. It's what Debbie, you mentioned earlier on, that really it's not only their HIV status. Have you started or gone through the menopause? 30% of the women who have answered have reported that. That is interesting. I'm sorry about that. In the past week, how able have you been to complete the following tasks without any assistance? We can see that almost 60% of the people had problems in order to do their food shopping. Almost 60% of the participants had difficulty in carrying out household tasks around, you know, also moving around their house. 90% of the participants expressed difficulty in moving around their house. If you have any difficulty with all those tasks, who is available to help you? And you can see that children, family, and the home support, which is paid for by them. What you could see in this slide is that the state does not provide any assistance to those people. Therefore, it's a huge burden on the family. Again, the family comes in order to pay the bill for those people. Do you currently care for or provide help at home to someone which you are not paid for? And yes, 25%, they take care either of their elderly parent or maybe their children. Do you have enough money to cover your basic needs? We see that no, never, and rarely, 50% of the participants have expressed financial difficulties. And money, again, we had the same. Money is a crucial. Those people have expressed, you know, that poverty is a major issue for them, like you found in your findings. Do you feel that you have or will have in the future care and support for their needs that are specific to or as a result of your HIV infection? 70% they said yes. So they worry how their needs are going to be met in the future. Have you made any financial plans? No, 73%. Because a lot of them, they live under the poverty line. And in their qualitative comments at the end, most of them said that they found their survey too long. And they wanted to be heard. So in their qualitative, in their open-ended answers, most of them said, please pass the message to the government, pass the message to the welfare system that we need extra funding, we need money to cover that. How often do you experience the following? A feeling that lack of companionship, feeling left out, 60%, they have expressed that. They said, some of the time and often, so from 60%, they have expressed that they're feeling left out or feeling isolated from others. So again, the social isolation. Interesting, Cyprus, sexuality is a problem, let alone homosexuality, let alone HIV and AIDS. Therefore, how many people have you told your HIV status? I have selected those slides. We could see that 30% have disclosed their HIV status to only one person, and another 30% to 2 to 5 people. So again, the social stigma comes into that. Who have you told about your HIV status? Family, children, friends, colleagues, support group, other spouse or partner? Do you feel concerned about growing older with HIV? Yes, 80%. Who would you turn to when seeking support with regards to growing older with HIV? Again, the family takes a lot of responsibility when it comes to that, and yet the family is unprepared to carry the burden of this, and the partner and the friends. Emotions, because of your age, because of HIV, both, we could see that feeling guilty, fear of being gossiped about, by being both HIV positive and being over 50. And the low self-esteem is important in all three. And you could see that the low self-esteem comes under the old age, and notice. Do you consider yourself to have been treated unfairly, either due to your HIV status or your age or both? We could see here, that's the important. At the hospital, you would expect doctors and nurses to have an understanding about people over 50 living with HIV, and yet at the hospital, we can see that both HIV status and age has been discriminated by doctors and nurses and neighbors as well. So the social surroundings and the medical surroundings have showed discrimination when it comes to both HIV status and the old age. Do you have any of the following concerns about growing older with HIV? Yes, difficulty finding a partner, employment, inability to get adequate health care, social care, inability to care for myself. Loneliness comes into that, and managing multiple health conditions, mental health issues, they come into that. Social stigma and discrimination. In order to give some time for discussion. The social context on the health of people living with HIV, I think, is more about community building. We must start talking about that. It's the most, I believe, the most effective things that can be done in order to advance HIV prevention. In Cyprus, we do not have any community building skills. We must introduce that. HIV prevention work, we must come up with mechanisms in order to take care of the self esteem factor. HIV prevention work is to communicate sufficiently specific messages that stimulate the recognition of situations of vulnerability. And also, those people, the HIV status, as very correctly and rightly Debbie said in the very beginning, cannot be separated, cannot be divorced from the emotional needs, sense of isolation, and sense of intimacy evident in the narratives of many of those people. And some implications for the service providers. Additional for Cyprus HIV clinics, there is only one HIV clinic in Cyprus. Health prevention programs, more doctors to be specialized in HIV, additional psychological support, welfare and benefits advice, and job opportunities. So, thank you for your attention. So, Polly, you see, 7:20, as you have instructed us, we have 40 minutes.
You were very disciplined.
Indeed.
Congratulations. Really, some fascinating presentations. Really, lots to chew on. Now we're going to go to questions. I have lots.
Yes.
But I'm going to restrain myself initially and go to the audience and see what's on people's minds. So just wait until you get the microphone and briefly identify yourself, and we'll go from there.
So my name is Alexander Zachariadis. I am a student at the International Relations Department at the university. I would like to ask, basically, what, in your experience, especially in Cyprus, what is the perception, or has there any betterment in the perception of the society towards people with HIV from the 80s until today? What's, is there any change? Are we moving forward on that front?
It's on. Thank you so much. I think a lot has been done when it comes to perception of people, of gay people living in Cyprus. Over the last 4 years, we had Gay Pride. It's the fourth one this coming round, this summer. But not much has been done when it comes to HIV, people living with HIV and AIDS, mainly because there is no organization in order to lobby for the rights of those people. There's only one organization, the AIDS Solidarity Movement. But again, it is run by heterosexual people or gay people who are not HIV positive. Therefore, the answer is no. Not much has been done in order to change the perceptions of the society when it comes to people living with HIV and AIDS. On top of that, you have the church in Cyprus, which plays a tremendous role in people's perception.
Thank you. My name is Sarigan. I'm a PhD student at LSE. My question concerns the explanation behind the different levels of access to healthcare in Cyprus. So you said like a quarter of them thought they have good access to healthcare, and three quarters didn't. So what explains the difference? Because in Cyprus, a lot of things depend on personal relations and, you know, nepotism. Do you think there's like a... Can we explain that level of difference through corruption, yes, essentially?
No, I think it's who you know in Cyprus. And if you have contacts with some good doctors in Cyprus, then, of course, you will jump the queue and will get the treatment that, you know. But also, some people choose to leave Cyprus in order to come to London. I know more than 10 people who are HIV positive who choose not to go to the clinic in Cyprus in order to be treated out of fear of being found out. And they choose to come to London in order to be treated. But going back to your question, the answer is yes. It's because they have maybe some good connections with doctors there. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Mohammed, and I'm not a student yet, but I hope next year. My question actually is for Debbie. I would like to ask you, do you think that NHS and the other health institutions in UK are ready to deal with the increase of number of old people living with HIV, and is there any policy in place to deal with it?
Thank you for your question, and good luck for next year. I hope you get in. I don't think we are HIV ready in both NHS and social care. There's lots of work happening. So one of my colleagues sat in the audience, and Terence Higgins Trust and many other organisations are thinking about how we can upskill the social care sector, in particular around HIV. And I said earlier about... I don't think it's malice. I think it's just they have their only impression of HIV was from the 1980s, and it was completely different. And there has been no big scale health promotion or health information campaign that's updated that knowledge. So NHS social care providers, they have regulations around zero discrimination. We need to put that into practice. I think we as charities have a role to play as... having a bit of a stick and making sure that individuals and social care providers are doing what they said they would do. I'm confident we will get there with regards to HIV. I think I worry more broadly around the sustainability of the social care sector. And if it comes down to ability to pay, as we know that many individuals living with HIV have huge issues around finances and poverty, that we have a job to do to make sure those individuals are getting the needs that they want.
There's another one right there.
Hello, thanks for your presentation. My name is Lan Chi. I'm a postgraduate student here at Social Policy and Development. So I have two questions. The first one is, I found it very interesting, like those like 80 plus, they mostly get HIV from heterosexual action, but the majority, like third, fourth, are men. So it means they get HIV from younger girls. Is there like a specific group of girls or women that get HIV from? And if we can detect like which specific group they get it from, maybe we can do something for the, I don't know, I'm just curious. And the second question is, it's mentioned that this fatigue of having protected sex is one of the reasons that resulted in this age, mm-hmm. result this HIV situation in aged people. So how should we deal with this fatigue? Because if you feel like from yourself that I don't want to do this anymore, it's not like you can just tell him, this is good, that is good, and they will just accept it. How do we change their mindset when they're in a fatigue? Thank you.
Should I say about the UK?
Yes,
and then, so in the UK, it's mixed, actually. So from the 50-plus population, it's both gay and bisexual men, but also heterosexual population. I think in the UK as well, it might be slightly different because there has been no targeted health promotion campaigns for the 50-plus population. So if you see anything out there at the moment, it's very much geared towards young people. So I think the first thing we need to do is really sense check all of our campaign messages going out around safer sex, or, you know, even the definition of that nowadays. What does that mean for somebody who's 50 plus? And you mentioned earlier, there is a lot around, in women in particular, coming out of long relationships or divorces and just thinking about, you know, I can't get pregnant anymore, therefore I'm fine. So it's just updating that knowledge as well. So I think we need to relook at the messages we're putting out there and really test them. So talk to people over 50 plus. You know, what would work for you? What do you think about this message? Because often we assume we know what people want without actually asking them. And so we need to change that.
Yeah. I was referring to the LGBT community. Over the last 20 years, they have been bombarded by messages when it comes to, and health campaigns, when it comes to safer sex and, you know, be careful not to catch HIV. And suddenly we have a young generation now, as well as the people over 50, 60, and 70. And for different reasons, the younger generation, they consider it as a treatable disease, a condition that can be treated. The older generation, the people over 50 and 60, for all the reasons we have explained, they are not bothered about, you know, HIV and AIDS, because they think that it does not affect them, and they have passed that. So really, that's the fatigue. How do we, by coming up with innovative health campaigns, by targeting young people, by, as you said, Debbie, very quickly, understanding what do they mean by safer sex and not making presumptions about their needs and hear them out, you know. And also from a methodological perspective, Mediterranean countries, Latin American countries, and Arab countries in Turkey and the Eastern European, sex between men, there's a difference between sexual behavior and sexual identity. So really there is a group of people who are men who have sex with men who are not identified as gay. Therefore, if you approach them by this survey or this questionnaire, which might label them as gay, they will or run away from it. They will not give us the responses that, you know, are worth exploring. So methodology, the language we use in Cyprus and the Mediterranean countries is very important if we want to target that group of people as well from the health perspective. Questions?
Hi, my name is Katerina Kniadaki. I'm a PhD student here at the European Institute. I was wondering, because I know that in Greece, the Greek crisis had an impact to the numbers of HIV-positive people. I was wondering whether this is the case in the recent crisis in Cyprus or maybe in the UK in 2008. And also the second question is about the correlation. You mentioned many people at the older age have multiple conditions at the same time, and that's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether, I'm not very much aware of the details of HIV, but is this a result of maybe having a repressed immune system, or is it just an age thing that just happens to everyone? And what's the how the welfare system tackles or doesn't tackle this? Mm-hmm.
I cannot talk about Greece, I can talk about Cyprus. Really, we have come out of the financial crisis, unlike Greece. I'm sorry to say. So really, it has not only affected the last few years the people living with HIV and AIDS, I think the government in Cyprus does not see it as a priority. They don't, because of the... Maybe, as you have seen, we have 1,000 cases, but officially registered. Mm. There are other people sitting and living with HIV, and they don't know about it, or they have chosen to come to England or to go to Europe in order to be tested rather than stay in Cyprus. So really, I can talk about... And the answer is yes, there has been a lot of cuts when it comes to the social welfare, but not only for the people living with HIV and AIDS, for everybody. The symptoms, well, if you are 60 or 70, really, they are interrelated, and it's very hard for a doctor. Usually, a doctor explains certain symptoms due to the old age rather than due to the HIV condition status. In Cyprus, very, very few doctors are trained to pick up and identify symptoms of HIV and AIDS over 60 or 70. Mm. As I said, there's only one clinic, really, who specializes for the whole island. And people, if they walk into the clinic, they may be seen. Mm. So they prefer to go to their GP, and the GP is totally ignorant about all those issues.
I want to put you both on the spot. Mm-hmm. I know that neither of you have sort of been able to delve into each other's data. Is that correct?
No. Correct.
So, on the fly, I mean, these aren't two cases that you would normally look at together, right? Yeah. There's a lot of differences across the two cases. But given what you've learned in each other's presentations, what have you learned that sort of that surprises you, perhaps? Something that you think the two countries can learn from each other? Similarities, differences, sort of your quick comparative analysis in a couple minutes.
I think the big thing that stuck out for me was sometimes I take for granted the HIV sector in the UK and the activism and the support we have for community organisations, and maybe not take it for granted, but I think there's definitely things we can learn, and we can share our learning from what's happened in the UK. I think it sort of links into your point as well, where there are huge amounts of cuts across public health, including HIV and sexual health, and HIV charities, community groups, sexual health services are really threatened. So I think it just reinforces in my head, listening to you, that we need to really ensure the sustainability of a voice to enable people to talk about themselves. So it's not about me or anyone else talking on behalf of people living with HIV. It's empowering them to talk about themselves for themselves. So my alarm bells are going, and that it's so difficult if you don't have that sort of third sector to fight the battle. That was a big thing that stuck in my mind.
Okay. What I am envious of is the great job that Terence Trust is doing, and other NGOs as well here in London, which we do not have. So I was thinking, if we had all that, so really what Debbie has shown me is the inadequacy of the Cypriot system, is that there is a gap in the market which needs to be filled in order to start talking about the meaningful findings that Debbie has presented. Unfortunately, you know, that we have a long way to go in Cyprus in order to do that. Similarities, that's the difference. The similarities, the social stigma, isolation, the financial problems those people are facing, they are there. It's a common denominator between the, you know. And I would like, and also, and I finish, I don't want to leave it there. I want to take it one step further and do something with the findings and, you know, present them to the government. And it's happening on the 28th of November in Cyprus.
That's really good. Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that both countries are probably dealing with cost-cutting, right? I mean, this is obviously something that in social care and public health in the UK that we sort of experiencing right now. So I wonder to what extent you could identify sort of some low-cost not solutions, but low-cost interventions that you could propose to policymakers in both countries that, you know, wouldn't demand that they set aside money that either they're unwilling to set aside or don't have in the first place, to try to at least tackle part of the problem. Debbie?
Yeah, I think in the UK, so I personally just wouldn't take that approach, because we in the UK there are, or in England at least, there are statutory services that local authorities, NHS, must provide for people living with HIV. And what's happening at the moment is that those organisations are looking for the low cost, for the cost cutting, and once those have gone, you'll never get them back. So for us, we are trying to be better about our cost effectiveness. So for every pound you get in, how much will the health and social care system save? And really making the case for why investment in HIV prevention and support services is so vital, and that's what it comes down to, is about the penny, the pound. So that's the case we're making. Yeah, it's depressing how it all comes down to money. So there are lots of interventions, thinking about peer support, thinking about health promotion, being really targeted in your approach, really understanding what you want your outcome to be. So that will make it less cost, but yeah. That's my red line.
Fair enough. Konstantinos?
Yes. What I have done last year, it's a low-cost method, is that I have persuaded the registrar at the university, when we have the induction week, you know, for students coming in, I have persuaded, you know, a group of students and the NGO in Cyprus when it comes to AIDS Solidarity Movement, in order to give two seminars to those students, to the newcomers,
really,
you know, which is, so again, we targeted 18 and 19 years old students, you know, coming at the university. During the induction week, I have managed to have two sessions on HIV and AIDS, which was important. Also, I gave them, you know, a kind of, it would come to me. For their books, you know, in order to have, you know,
a bookmark
with HIV, basic information about HIV and AIDS and all that, which was, you know, again, students, you know, unfortunate because of my position at the university, we have a pool of students there, and we have a dance group and a theater program there, and next summer, May 2018. They are coming up with a dance piece and a theater piece in order to promote HIV and AIDS rights among. So again, I am mobilizing young people at the university in order to promote that. Low cost, yes, but you know, effective.
Yeah.
Right.
And I just, that's where again I take for granted a wee bit. So the government in this country is a few months ago committed to making, well, relationships and sex education, not sex and relationships, because we can't have sex at the beginning of a subject. So relationships and sex education compulsory in all schools from 2019. And so we, Terence Higgins Trust and many other organisations are ensuring that that's LGBT inclusive, that that includes HIV, includes sexual health. And yeah, I yet again, something else I've kind of slightly taken for granted, maybe, that that's a great opportunity to say primary school age and secondary school. But yeah, it's a good intervention.
Yes.
There does seem to be sort of inadequate messaging and education in both contexts, right? Which is surprising in the case of the UK, because you expect people to know really lots about HIV, and yet people in the social care sector still have these misconceptions about how it's spread. Any final? We'll go. Let's take three together, okay?
Yes, indeed.
Sam. John, and then this gentleman right here.
I've got to choose a question now.
Okay.
First of all, tiny question. You mentioned that, Konstantinos, in Cyprus there were medical professionals, very few of them, that could pick out HIV symptoms in the 50-plus. Mm-hmm. Is that the same in the UK?
We have HIV specialist consultants. So once somebody's referred in, it's easy as. We have really good tests, so technically it shouldn't be that difficult. The problem in the UK is, one, we're around primary care and GPs, so often GPs don't think HIV, especially in the 50-plus population. And it's just, there's so many routes that people can test for HIV. It's just ensuring people are thinking HIV and getting in. So testing, diagnosis is fine once you're in specialisms. It's especially primary care getting them interested. That makes sense.
Actually, I have two questions. Can I ask both of them? Okay, thank you. My name is John. I'm a master's student here in LSE. Actually, I used to work for an LGBT organization in China for 4 years. So, like, I'm also curious about, like, do you think, both of you, do you think the aging people with HIV is a global issue, or just, like, European or American, where will be considered as more like a developed part of the world? And my second question is, in terms of the policy interventions, do you think it should be more focused on the social service for general elderly peoples, or like it should be focused more on HIV interventions for elderly peoples? Thank you.
Thank you for your brilliant presentation. My name is Zhong Yucai. I am a foundation student in KCER, maybe a prospective student in LSE. Oh. And I have one question. Is it as what you had mentioned in the presentation? Is it possible that in the course of helping those people get the HIV, and help them out, will cause discrimination, or as consider it as a kind of invasion of the privacy? And is it some possible method for us to tackle this problem? Thank you.
Great, thanks. Three questions.
Sure. Yes.
Who wants to start?
The first one is it a global issue? I would say yes, but absolutely. The statistics, and I'm sorry if I don't know the statistics when it comes to the global, but the most recent European survey was published in September 2017 in The Lancet, and it shows that as a European in Europe, it is a major issue. The global issue, I have presented some statistics from the United States, which I believe it shows that it's growing there as well. So I believe, yes, it is a global issue. It is not only a European issue. Social services, if they are to be disconnected, I strongly believe that they should be focusing on the elderly people living with HIV and AIDS. Otherwise, if it is just for elderly people, again, we tend to silence those, that group of people. So, yes, I strongly believe that they should be specifically targeted in order to bring out in the open that part of the, and helping in discrimination, whether if I understood correctly, if we specifically help those people, are we maybe discriminating them? But I think the purpose of tonight's presentation exactly answers this question, because we have shown that those people are crying for attention. They need help. And we have to go out there and help them. Whether we discriminate them, I think it's society's problem. It's not, if I understood correctly, your question.
And I would just add, so aging and HIV is a global issue in developing countries as well. So UNAIDS, which is the UN body that leads HIV and AIDS response, sees aging as one of the key issues in the future. There are still access issues to HIV treatment in some countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. So in some ways, some of the issues are slightly different, but we definitely, across in every country in the world, have an aging population living with HIV. So this is only going to increase as an issue across the world. Generalised versus specialist. Mm. Personally, in England or the UK, I would say both. So I think that we need to upskill anybody who works in the NHS social care sector. I think that everybody should have a basic level of knowledge around HIV. I think there's a cohort of people living with HIV who will need extra support, extra needs, have maybe complex needs in some way, who might need additional support. But I think we need to consider both. Mm. And especially as costs are reducing, I think we need to think innovatively about how we can work through more general services. And on your final question, I think that it is up to an individual to share their status. Nobody should force anybody to disclose their status to anyone else. And our role is to think about how we can support and empower that individual if they would like to disclose at a time that works for them. And we also do a lot of work, as with many other organisations, to support people who living with HIV who have felt discrimination for whatever reason. But it should always be that individual makes their own decision. That makes sense.
Another question right there.
Is it open? Oh. Yes. My question links with the very last one, actually. It's on discrimination law. So in the UK, I presume no one can discriminate against people with HIV under the 2010 Equality Act, probably.
Yes. There you go.
Is there a similar piece of legislation in Cyprus? So 10% of people, complained that medical staff were kind of discriminatory against them because of their HIV status. Can they press charges against them?
They can, but they do not. Don't forget, all those people, they will not do that, because if they do that, it's like coming out for being HIV. So really, it's a catch-22 situation. The answer is yes, there is legislation there to protect them, but until now, nobody has taken up on that, unfortunately. Mm.
Unless there are any other questions, I have one more.
Yes, of course.
Just to sort of sum up. So particularly when you think about your own particular study's findings, can you tell us, again, just sort of off the top of your head, what did you find most depressing and what do you find most promising from your results? What sort of gives you hope? So first, the bad news.
The bad news for me, it was that sense of social isolation and depression and the financial adversities those people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The good news is that throughout the 28 questionnaires and throughout the interviews, in the open-ended answers, there was this cry, they are desperate to be heard. Mm. So it's good news that they are already, I think slowly it's changing. They want something to be done. And there is a momentum now that I would like to take advantage of that into something.
That's really good. Great. I think mine are sort of two sides of the same coin. So the most depressing is the cases of discrimination in social care sector that we found, and I kind of knew it was happening, but when you hear those real stories, it's it really got to me. The positive is that there's interventions we are doing to change that, and so it's an issue that can be addressed. So the findings of our report, we got a lot of good press around it, and it means that there's an organisation for Skills for Care who are responsible for training up social care providers. So they're working with us. They're really keen to change practice. There's a really good swell of appetite to really change attitudes around HIV in the social care sector. So it's so depressing, but the good news is we can do and we are doing something about it.
Mm. And very quickly, on the 20th of November, the good news is that I'm presenting the findings in Munich, and the media will be there, and the TV channels and the newspapers. So for the first time ever, this issue will be brought out in the open.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I want to thank, obviously, Konstantinos and Debbie for incredibly interesting presentations, and I want to thank you all for coming out on this slightly chilly autumnal day. I found it incredibly interesting and enlightening. So let's all give our speakers a round of applause.